an absolute pleasure to be here. And, you know, thank you, Nicholas, and to Capital Link and to North Shipping and to DNV, yes. So I'm honored to be joined by, you know, Carl-Johan Hagman and the president and CEO of NYK Group Europe, Mr. Harald Fatland, who's president of the Norwegian Shipowners Association and CEO of Odfjell, Dr. Gabby Bornheim, president of the German Shipowners Association and managing director of Peter Dohl Schifffahrts KG, and Mr. Hing Chow, co-founder and chairman of the Hong Kong Chamber of Shipping and executive chairman of Hua Kuang Maritime Transport Holdings Limited. There's been no shortage of headlines, and I'm just going to move to the seat so that we can handheld mics. And, you know, I think that there's no shortage of headlines from my perch in the United States as to tariffs and trade policy and, you know, whether shipping is really in a storm or if it's more of a long-term kind of realignment. And so I just thought that we would start with some opening remarks from each of the panelists and from their perspective as to how they see these challenges and, you know, how to handle what, you know, frankly is, you know, changing by the day. As I was preparing for this panel, you know, I said, well, maybe we should do a summary of what the tariffs look like. And then there was a legal decision in the United States that upended half of them. And then the next day you get a tweet that actually it's instead of 25%, it's 50% tariffs. So from your perspective, company by company, maybe we should start, Mr. Hagman.
So in the mornings, I hardly want to watch the news anymore because it's sort of, it really does change in a pace that it hasn't changed before. So from that point of view, I think operationally we are in an environment that at least I haven't seen in my 30 odd years in shipping. On the other hand, I must say, the history of shipping since 300-400 years back is dealing with change, and I think the industry has been extraordinarily resilient in managing these shifts. So I think even though that we struggle now, we've always been struggling, and this somehow is shipping, and therefore, I think yes, we are concerned. On the other hand, that does not stop and. At least the company I represent, we're 140 years old, so we've seen a couple of these things. And I'll then leave it to my other panelists because this one is a difficult one to summarize.
I think in the long term, we can probably see a little bit more clarity with the MEPC 83 that just passed a month and a half ago. The longer term commitment to carbonization is clear, and the pathway, even though there is a unilateral withdrawal, we all know who that is, that pathway is relatively clear. I think hopefully that will be further endorsed in October. I think another clarity in terms of a geopolitical landscape is China-US tension that will probably remain. Shorter term, that's volatility, right? And that is anyone's guess in the short term. So I think for a shipping company like ourselves, how to remain nimble on our feet, tactical flexibility in the short term, whilst having very firm long-term aims and objectives, very important.
Difficult to add something more. It's difficult to add some more perspectives, but I would say shipping is not a luxury, it's a necessity, and that is something which is more and more seen by governments and maybe by one government, especially the US government, because otherwise you could not explain why they try to support their own yacht industry by introducing these kind of port fees, if this is the right way. Okay, I have my doubts, but who am I to criticize Mr. Trump? But no, I agree. If you are in shipping, it's in your DNA to adapt to changes, to adapt to crises. And I would say agility is the new currency for shipping. We have to adapt to all these changes, and we have now to accommodate not only to geopolitical tensions, frictions. We have to see how the U.S. will act with regard to defense costs and how. For example, Europe will find a setting within that. So, but it remains challenging. We have been going through the finance crisis. We have been going through the pandemic. We are still here because shipping is a necessity, and there will nobody be in stopping this globalization. And so, shipping is there and will remain.
Good morning. Everyone, I think the headlines are uncertainty and inefficiency. And I also think that there is little the individual ship owner can do when it comes to countries wanting to implement tariffs. So what we are doing is, of course, we are trying to understand what's going on. We are trying to adapt to what's coming. And I think most importantly, we are maintaining close dialogues with our customers to assist them in handling the challenges they experience when it comes to imports and exports. So what we see is the headline is uncertainty and inefficiency. That's so far the consequences of what's going on.
Thank you so much. I mean, I think that the U.S. Port fee proposals is a subject that is going to be of great interest for the ship owners in this room and the folks that you represent on your ship owners associations. Those port fee proposals look like they're going into effect as of October of 2025, based on the last meeting that was held in Washington D.C. And so, how do you feel the ship owners associations are going to react to that? Are there going to be operational changes, financing changes? What are you seeing?
Well, I think first of all, I think the Trump administration, it's great that they are addressing a topic that is important to all of us, namely that we have become, I think, way too dependent on one shipbuilding nation. So far, we fully agree with the fact that we have to address that that we should have more options available when it comes to shipbuilding. And then I think many, or if not all of us, disagree in the measures to handle that problem. The proposals that were initially proposed by the Trump administration ranged from zero impact to maximum impact, and now we see that particularly car carriers and container vessels they might be getting the hardest hit, and maybe particular car carriers because it's measured on the lane meters on and not on the cargo being imported. But the consequences of all this is that every ship owner is now trying to adapt the fleet allocation to those port tariffs, and that is also creating inefficiencies because certain vessels are being routed away from the US while other vessels are routed into the US. So I think all in all the effect depends on the segment, but in total, this creates more inefficiencies and by that also more costly transportation for all of us, whether we are sailing on the US or in Europe or in Asia.
Yeah, so I think we have a pretty good history of actually passing these costs on to our customers. I mean, regretfully, that is what's going to happen. And yeah, representing maybe the world's largest car carrier. I don't know if Lasse is in the room, but no, we're not changing our operational routings. Again, representing Japan, it might not be a bad thing for Japanese and Korean shipbuilding, which we agree entirely is the world needs to be rebalanced. But on the other hand, the Chinese are very, very competitive, and this is going to drive up costs. Regretfully, in my view, that will eat up global prosperity, which previously has ended up with the end consumer. So we'll see.
Yeah, maybe at the moment we are hardly, especially as container ship owners, we take advantage for this period until October. That's what we can see. Rates have risen, but okay, this will come to an end very soon. And then I think I totally agree with you. We all as consumers will bear the cost, especially the American consumers. Okay, partly it might strengthen the dollar, this might ease a little bit the effects, but nonetheless, it will become a tough time for all of us.
But it is interesting also how resilient our industry is, I think, in the sense that when this first came out, at least my thought was, this is completely impossible. It cannot happen. Huh? And then it gets revised, you get accustomed to it, and all of a sudden, it's just another sort of issue to be dealt with in the daily operations.
The particular organization I represent, Hong Kong Chamber of Shipping, is not a ship owners association. Rather, it represents the interest of key stakeholders along the maritime trade value chain. So amongst our members, we have major port groups. We have leasing companies, such as some of the usual suspects that all of you are very familiar with. We have major ship owners, cargo carriers, operators, and maritime law firms, etc. So from a Hong Kong and Chinese perspective, first of all, the 301 is discriminatory. There is no reason why Chinese shipbuilding and Chinese ship owner in particular ought to be targeted in that manner. And I, speaking on behalf of my members sitting in Hong Kong, we feel very much the brunt, victimized by this US policy. So first of all, it's targeted, it's discriminatory, it's unfair, and it's against the spirit of free trade. First comment. Second comment is that I think the only way to respond to it is by working more cohesively together. So unfortunately, certain lines, particularly where Chinese owners and shipping companies are concerned, have significant US exposure. For example, container, for example, oil and gas, okay, gas, because US can't deal with it for the time being, it's postponed to 2028. Let's see if the current president is still around to carry on the same policy in 28. In the meantime, I think the exposure to bulk carriers are minimized, and we see that there are exceptions being made in favor of basically the ship types, which the US operators really require. So in that essence, if we reduce all of this to its essence, I think, you know, the pressure point on Chinese companies are really container and tankers. And so I think certain companies that will be affected, they can no longer trade, and this will leave a gap for certain other companies. And I think, you know, because the definition of owners quite extensive, extend beyond what we traditionally understand ship owners, and I think all of you understand what I mean. That means capital will probably also go elsewhere to funnel other types of trade.
You know, those are all really incisive comments, and you know, I think that you start to get at some of the complexity here, that it's not just monolithic, there's different segments. Some of which are more affected and less affected. And when the first proposal came out, which I think would have been in January, February, it was monolithic, and it thought only of container shipping, $1 million or $1.5 million per port call, without considering, you know, short voyage vessels, bulk carriers, different segments. And so the government was educated. There were about 600 comments, including a very positive comment from the Hanwha Shipyard, said, "We love this Korean shipbuilding. This is great," and which was, I thought, the most unintentionally funny letter that was submitted. But you know, and great for them, they're representing their interests. But everybody kind of commented on that, and there were 2 days of public hearings in March. Now the new proposal, they seem to have understood. Well, there are different segments, but we have this totally new car carrier annex, which does not focus only on China, but any foreign car carrier, which is totally unrelated to the initial investigation. So I think one question, and nobody has to
have a clear answer to this, but, you know, is anyone looking at challenging these in a more formal way? And do you think that anyone would be, because you had tariff challenges that were recently successful last week, and would anybody be interested in challenging the port fee proposals in a more formal litigated way? Or do you think that the more effective way would be to simply continue to engage as industry has been engaging with comments to the government in the administrative process, and you know, no comment is a valid response.
No, but I don't think, I mean, many of us are in the shipping business. We're not in the litigation business and yeah. picking fights with the world's largest economy. I think we adapt. I would think, and I think last year the number was 86% of all new orders went to Chinese shipyards. In Europe, we slapped 40% tariffs on Chinese EVs during the last 12 months. Imports into Europe have not gone down, they've gone up. So, I mean, it just demonstrates the extreme competitiveness of whether it's Chinese EVs or Chinese shipbuilding. And I think, at least for my company, I think it would be it would have to go quite far before we started ordering vessels in the United States, simply by virtue of the fact that what we're getting in China, and we think Japan, Korea, is extraordinarily competitive. And replacing that based on market considerations, I think is going to be very, very difficult.
For us, it's fundamentally a political issue. So rather than trying to engage the US directly, we submit our thoughts as industry and as representatives of different stakeholders along supply chain, and we submit that to the national government in China and, you know, let them know our view, our concerns.
I think there was the last hearing on 19th May, but I think our port fees were under no, they were not even mentioned any longer. So this seems now to be set. And to go against it, I think who should sue whom? You are the lawyer. You should tell us.
Betraying my bias as a litigator.
And so I think we will have to adapt. And so we have to reroute, we will have to find our ways, but we will adapt. If that is an, and I, in my personal view, I will expect that it will not take for that long. It will be maybe he will change his attitude in a year's time. Midterm election 2026, November, maybe this helps. I don't know, but if then the consequences are felt more by the US consumers, he might shift away. I don't know, but that is more the language I suppose Mr. Trump understands, not suing him for something which we can't.
I think when it comes to kind of reacting to the port fee proposal, then you have to remember that when the initial proposal was known, that was when the debate around Greenland, around Canada, and the Panama Canal was maybe at its warmest. So my perception in Europe was that none of the European countries were willing to send a hearing response to the proposal because they didn't want to attract attention. Actually, the only country in Europe that I know about that reacted to the proposal was Norway, who sent a quite direct response to the proposal.
Also, the ICS did some extensive comments, the International Chamber of Shipping.
Yeah.
Well, I think it raises, you know, potentially another topic here or another theme, which is that of divergence. And you see kind of the U.S. starting to take a different path from some of the other governments with respect to sanctions. You have a very different view from the current administration as to Russia, or at least a different posture, and sanctions continue against Russia as the conflict continues to rage in the Ukraine, but you have continued packages of sanctions in the EU, the 17th, the 18th packages, and you haven't had really notable action from the United States on that front.
And similarly, there's been much more of a turn towards Iran and China, which, you know, is not something that you see from some other jurisdictions. So I think, and then, you know, I think it will come up in the next topic that I want to talk about as well, which is decarbonization. But how do you see the risk of divergence, you know, from where you sit with respect to these issues?
Well,
a little broad.
Well, I guess we've been, from my point of view, we've been phenomenally blessed in the world that we've had a golden age where we've traded a lot with each other. I mean, from the fall of the Berlin Wall to Chinese ascendance into the WTO. And if I can just share, my personal favorite statistic is that today we're 8 billion people in the world. It's a moral disaster that 700 million of those are under the poverty line. But let's celebrate the fact that 77.3 billion are not. 1980, we had 4.5 billion people on Earth. 40% of those were under the global poverty line. Now, that means that today we have about 4.5 billion new consumers, because today average GDP per capita is $12,300. That's what we had in Norway and Sweden in 1978. So can you imagine, we have 4.5 billion more consumers that are consuming roughly what we did in 1980. And as I can remember it, at least, that was a pretty good time. So I think, yes, there is divergence. Yes, we are, or at least we're quite concerned. But if we order a vessel today, we get delivery 2029. We're going to operate it until 2000, what do I know, 60. And I think it's much more the macro trend, at least in our company, that we're looking at. And yes, we have a bumpy road from a Western values point of view. And the world is getting a lot more complex. On the other hand, I mean, we've never had more prosperity. We've never consumed more than we're doing today. And I still think that many consumers don't walk into a store and say, now I'm going to buy something really expensive with really bad quality. So I think every time those 8 billion people actually do make everyday choices, it underpins globalization. And that's very much what our industry is about.
I would like to jump in here. I think divergence is a word we use when we look at the global geopolitical landscape, which is a world that's becoming more fragmented, whereas the Western Hemisphere, at least US, EU, tend to go hand in hand in a lot of understanding issues, policies around the world. That's no longer the case. We see increasing fragmentation in that regard. So that consensus is getting thin. However, in the economic sense, I prefer to use the other term, diversification. And diversification, I think, is good for the world because, as has been mentioned by other panelists this morning, we need resilience. And resilience comes from having optionality, coming from different trade routes, which are being born as we speak, because we're at that fundamental moment in time where a lot of things are changing. Decarbonization is something we're going to talk about. That in itself will bring about new supply chain, new demand supply, and new type of economics around the world. But at the same time, we look at BRICS. We look at Belt and Road coming out of China. So we see that going forward, there will be a lot more optionality and diversification in terms of global trade. And I see that as a world of opportunities.
Let me break it down to the level of an entity or of an entrepreneur who has to make his decisions. And so I can tell you for the company which pays me, Peter Dole, that we have actually ordered vessels in China last year, and we did it again this year against my advice. So I'm only the legal eagle within. So, but it shows you that there is the acknowledgement of the pricing in China. We even did Chinese leasing now for the first time. So quite an experience, but anyhow, so we will be facing these difficulties, but we will find a way around, and we have to work around. And this is the Trump administration will have its time, and what comes after that, we will see. Ships are built not only for 5 years, they will remain for 30 years, and they have to be built in a way that we can work with them for that long time, and that is what counts. And so maybe that is one answer to your questions, but not the only one.
I think this is not about China as such. This is about one country getting a more or less a monopoly in certain segments. Having said that, we should also recognize China for quality, for willingness to innovate, for kind of meeting customers' demands when it comes to shipbuilding. So there are plenty of great things to say about China as a shipbuilding nation. The challenge is that the access to capacity is becoming more and more limited. That is what should be worrying ship owners.
You know, I had mentioned decarbonization before because I thought it might represent one example of divergence, because, you know, the U.S. withdrew from the IMO negotiations in April. And, you know, the rest of the global community move forward with net zero. And so, you know, it's one kind of symptom. Maybe it's a protectionist impulse on the U.S. part. But, you know, you see the IMO kind of moving forward with net zero. And as a ship owner or, you know, representing your members, you need to think about, you know, planning for the next 5, 10, 15 years. And Mr. Chow, you mentioned optionality. So what types of, you know, is there a particular fuel source that you're looking at? Are you taking an all of the above strategy? How are you looking at that sort of?
Something we're doing currently is that we're building supply chain conversations. So since the beginning of the Hong Kong Chamber of Shipping, we have started getting stakeholders around the table who are involved in the future supply chain of green methanol, green hydrogen, and green ammonia. China-centric at this moment in terms of production, because we see China having a lot of potential for this type of development, but we do intend in the near future to extend that conversation to our friends around the world. And indeed, since the beginning, we also work with other partners like Global Maritime Forum in sort of interweaving these discussions together, because I think global maritime community, we are all concerned about decarbonization. The solution cannot come from one place, and no country can tackle decarbonization on its own. So having this type of supply chain conversation beyond shipping, from day one, I said, and a lot of my friends have said, that shipping cannot decarbonize itself. We need partnership with government. We need partnership around the world, and we need to bring in the energy sector, the tech sector. We are all part of the same energy transition, and we have to have this type of conversation to move forward.
Yeah, I think EU is a good example here. First, EU has proved to the world that it's possible to implement a carbon tax for shipping, the EU ETS. The EU has also proved to the world that it's possible to implement a fuel standard through the Fuel EU Maritime. So far, what EU has done with respect to proving to the world that this is actually possible is great. Where the EU failed is that they've added an additional regional tax on European industries at a time industries in EU was already struggling. So the learning from those three observations is that we need a global tax, and that is why the IMO decision in October is so extremely important, that we managed to get this deal signed and done. The EU has proved it's possible, both when it comes to taxation and when it comes to the fuel standard, but it cannot be done regionally or locally. It has to be done globally. So I sincerely hope that what we will see in October is that the EU votes for this new regulation.
I think that's a real hope we all have. Otherwise, we split up and look at China also implementing a system, Turkey. This will not work. We are in a global industry and we need internationalized regulation. So hopefully the IMO proposal will come to effect in October. But if not, okay, again, then we have to adapt with that. This makes a lot of more noise and lot of more work for all of us. But also then we have to adapt to that. So it's here's again, agility means, or is the currency of shipping again. And we can complain about the availability of the fuels. We can't decide as tramp owners. We are only the followers to the liner companies on the container side. So that's all the given facts to which we have to accommodate. And then we will see for some trades, batteries are fine, intercoastal carriers, that's fine. And even to think about nuclear is not forbidden any longer. In this kind of conversation, we have to be open to all the solutions which are there. If we want, and that's what we have stated as the first industry, that we want to act carbon neutral. So that we have to follow.
And I guess my comment would be that I would think that having a unified UNCLOS IMO system is much more important than American tariffs, in the sense that here we have 83% of the world's 73% of the world's surfaces water. It's been regulated in one way since 1609, and ripping that apart on our guard, I think, would be really bad. And I think maybe that is actually what is happening. I mean, now the EU takes 10 billion euro a year from the shipping industry, and I don't see that money coming back into the shipping industry for countries like Japan. It does trigger a lot of questions. I think we should be looking at what Africa is doing right now. They are building schemes that, yes, the global south wants money, so you create your own scheme. So we actually are threatening the whole system. And I agree with the other panelists that I think it was great that MEPC 83 got an agreement. And I guess the formal line is, yes, that is fantastic that we managed to show unity. But I think two things. One is, it's so complicated, and there was nobody in the room from the shipping industry that put these regulations in place. And at least I don't really understand them, and I certainly don't understand how we're going to be able to implement them. The second is that I think from a personal point of view, I mean, it was such a lost opportunity. We emit a billion tons of CO2 a year, plus or minus. And I would argue that it's not super difficult to abate. We run an ammonia tugboat in Tokyo Bay since 18 months back. It does work. So, I mean, there are technical solutions, but there are not financial mechanisms. And I think a global structure would have been able to show that we could have decarbonized at a much, much quicker pace. I mean, surely this will happen. It's just a question of how worried are we? How much is the house on fire? And I would have just thought from a societal point of view that this would have been an easy win, because at least in our company, with the proposals that ICS and the EU and Japan and some other countries had initially submitted to MEPC 83, the calculations in our company would have been roughly a 30% rate increase. Now, a 30% rate increase when we've seen 100% volatility in the container market and many other markets over the past 2-3 years, I think we could have easily absorbed. And therefore, it was really a lost opportunity, and how do we now make up for that in the coming years, I think, is our big challenge.
You know, it seems as though the consensus on the panel is that cooperation is better than competition, and you've got a global shipping industry. You can't really just break it down across borders. You know, at least three of the panelists are you know, leading ship owners associations or chambers of shipping. You know, how do you see it, you know, in terms of showing leadership and engaging to kind of foster that cooperation so that it's not just regional cooperation but global cooperation? And you know, one aspect of that is this conference. You know, we're all talking to each other, how do you lead the way when it comes to cooperation?
Yeah, we're at Nor-Shipping. Yes, I know, but I think we know. I mean,
Thank you, Nick. We're
so fortunate. And yes, here we are, four different ship owners associations, and I mean, on a relatively regular basis, we meet in ICS. On we all come from a ship owning background, I think the wonderful part of the industry is that we are so global, and we have so many interactions, both in the political sphere, but also in the daily operations sphere.
Yeah, and I think we all know that we have to invest, and it's as Carl stated, it's the most important thing that the money goes back to the industry, at least partly, so that we can have this kind of motor to invest, and again, not longer to be not carbon neutral. So that is, I think, that is a vehicle which is already implemented in our thoughts, and that there are different attitudes by different countries, which is clear. Carl has made his words very clear about poverty on Earth and how the third world states like to get the money out of that. But this is only part of the discussion, and I think we are, as ship-owning entities, we are aligned. We have also different attitudes or discussions with not only one unique opinion, but we know where we want to head for, and that means, we will see what the IMO will deliver in October, and again, how the US will behave or not.
I think there is significant cooperation going on, and it has done for the past decade. We are cooperating locally in the domestic shipowners association. We are, as mentioned, cooperating through ICS, through the European shipowners. We are feeding IMO with information, and we do achieve results. The challenge is that we are basically doing this alone in the total value chain. There is, in my opinion, almost zero interest among our customers to pay for the solutions. So everything that we do has to be self-funded. So with the customers out of the equation, and then we have the IMO and national and regional authorities and governments, they are not able to implement good solutions, and that leaves ship owners more or less alone in trying to find solutions to the green transition. And there is a limit for how much a ship owner or ship owners can do alone without support from the total value chain, and I think that's what we are facing these days.
But and if I can just add again, so yes, but we're always leaning back on having one common regulation. So I mean, if we just have a common playing field, and just belaboring the point again of how incredibly important the IMO system is. So as long as we have a level playing field, we're going to hash this out in one way or another. But actually, if that level playing field is now being sort of challenged, I think that can really hurt the industry.
I think at this moment of radical structural change, platform like this is extremely important. So we bring stakeholders around the world, starting different points of the value chain to engage and talk to one another, exchange view openly, and see if we can find common pathways, opportunities to work together. At the same time, I must repeat that we need to weave this conversation much more broadly into other industrial sectors, particularly in the energy sector, as well as in commodities, mining, etc., because they are all part of this broader transition that we are all going through. So I think, how we structure such partnership and how we structure future forums will also be important, because I emphasize it shouldn't just be shipping companies talking to one another. That will only take us so far. We need regulators. We need our downstream customers. We need our upstream suppliers. All of them are part of this conversation.
Well, I think we have about 2 minutes left. So, if anyone has time for any concluding thoughts, looking ahead, I think we've covered quite a broad array of topics. And, I think it's a great kickoff to the week. So, I want to thank all of the panelists for their views today. Any concluding thoughts? No.
We're going to get through this one as well.
Very good. So, thank you very much.